state punishment. State punishment.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. I'm Lyle Koenig. I am here this afternoon for Rogers. I have structured this argument around a short chronology of facts. On March 21st of 2012, the Supreme Court of the United States decided Frye versus Missouri. At that time, an appeal for post-conviction relief was pending in this court. And therefore, the District Court of Jefferson County, Nebraska did not have jurisdiction in this case.
Well, it wouldn't have had jurisdiction, perhaps any order, enter any orders, but did that prohibit you from filing anything during an appeal time?
I think it did, Your Honor, because I believe that if I understand the concept of jurisdiction, we couldn't have filed anything as long as the first post-conviction relief action was on file here. In other words, it would have been a nullity. That's my view. That it would have been a nullity to have filed. I don't think the court would have taken jurisdiction, at least so far as I know. Then on March 26th of 2012,
the court would prohibit you.
It wouldn't prohibit it, wouldn't prohibit me from filing the document, but it
happened in March, nothing but happened in March, until we were done with the listen.
Well, that's right. I don't If that is the case, Your Honor, I have never seen that before in my life. But there is authority for that. I have to tell you. I will tell you. I have never seen that.
I'm just thinking that way.
All right. Then on March 26, 2012, I have previously asked the county attorney for whether or not there have been any plea offer made, because you know I didn't try it, so I didn't know. By the way, out of candor, I have to tell you there was a mistake in my brief. I think in my brief I said that I showed the letter to Mr. Smith on March 28th of 2013. It's March 26th of 2012, and that's in the record, and that's the fact. Then on March 19th of 2013, this court decided pending appeal. On February 21st of 2014, the Supreme Court of Nebraska decided the case of State versus Alfredson, clarifying Frye versus Missouri. And then 20 days later, on March 13th of 2014, we filed the appeal, or should be the petition, that brings us to court today. So, the limitation period begins when the facts underlying the claim could have been reasonably discovered, I understand that. But we couldn't have discovered it before the time that we did, simply because the letter was not in the file. The facts before you show that Sharon Smith picked up the file from Mr. Green sometime in 2010. Gave it to me. She testified in court that it was not in there. It was not in there.
What we do, though, with the court's factual finding, based upon Mr. Green's testimony that the offer was communicated, do we have to apply a clearly erroneous standard to that finding?
Well, you probably do, and I have to tell you, I think it's certainly erroneous. Think about this for a moment. You are experienced judges, and you are experienced lawyers. Here's the situation. The situation was that this gentleman was facing 125 years in jail and a $50,000 fine. It is stated that his counsel came to him and said, listen, We can walk you out of this for 15 years and 30,000. With good time, we're talking about 7.5 years as opposed to 62.5 years. I have to say that I think the court's conclusion is erroneous. I cannot believe that he would have rejected that. Now, mind you, Mr. Green testified at the hearing that he never showed him the letter. The letter is not in the file. We didn't know about the letter, the plea offer. We didn't know about the plea offer until I contacted the county attorney in 2012, and she sent me a copy. That was the first time we knew that a plea offer had been made. Mr. Smith testified at the hearing in this case that that's the first time he knew it. His wife and his daughter both testified that that was the first time they knew about it. If you consider the facts of this case, it seems to me that you must conclude that is true, that is the first time they knew about it, because it simply staggers the imagination that if this plea agreement was made, and he was looking at 125 years, with another thing. So that is our position. The one-year statute, we believe that is identified in our brief and is identified in the brief of the state, began to run against us when the court clarified the rule that was announced by Frye versus Missouri in the Alpentine case. And that case was decided on February 21st of 2014. And in that case, and I apologize for reading you the language, but I feel like I must. The Nebraska Supreme Court recognized an ambiguity that had previously appeared in our law. I announced that case as well as State versus Lopez, in which the Supreme Court said that the failure to communicate a plea offer was deficient as a matter of law. It was not clear about whether that applied to just murder cases or all cases. And then in the Albertson case, they clarified it. And in doing so, they mentioned the case of Missouri versus Frye, and they said that the Supreme Court has recently clarified the rule. And this is what our Supreme Court said. We now hold. Now, this is on February 21st of 2014. We now hold that as a general rule, defense counsel has the duty to communicate to the defendant all formal offers made from the prosecution to accept the plea. So it's argued that the law of Nebraska was established on February 21st, 2014.
Even Alfredson, though, also recognized that it had previously made that holding in Irvine. But because the language of Frye versus Missouri, that opinion came out subsequently, yes. Irvine, yeah. It stated that it can't.
That's well, but it says. It can't be. All right. Well, anyway, it said that we have now clarified the rule, and then they announced the holding, and we filed our petition in this case 20 days later. So we did it immediately after Alfredson was decided. So we think we're within the 1 year. I would like to reserve the rest of my time. If you have no other questions. Thank you.
May it please the court, Mayor and Tangerman, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Nebraska. The issue before this court is fairly straightforward, whether the appellant's second motion for post-motion relief was timely filed under either subsection 4B or 4D of 29 of 2001.
Tangerman, I don't believe in your brief you addressed the Alfredson case.
I
would like to do that by auditory.
Yes. For Alfredson to apply as the Alliance Council says it does, the Nebraska Supreme Court would have to not only specifically state that it's announcing a new constitutional rule, but it would have to specifically state that that new constitutional rule is retroactive to cases on collateral review. The court did not do that. The court made it clear that we have addressed, that they had addressed the ineffective assistance of counsel claims in the plea bargaining process before. It was in 2011 in Aramagna, 2008 in Sadie Lopez, but that they had not gone into depth. And they know, they mentioned that the United States Supreme Court had clarified the issue in Missouri, and so therefore they went on to discuss Missouri disbarment in that context. So that is the state's position. The state will also note that we cited in our briefs that 8th Circuit Court 8-0, along with the 2nd Circuit, the 5th Circuit, the 7th Circuit, the 9th Circuit, the 11th Circuit, have all held that Missouri will apply and Lockwood v. Cooper did not announce any new constitutional law. And furthermore, even if all of those circuits are wrong, there is still not a case holding Missouri v. Crockett retroactive to cases on collateral review.
Hinges on the court's factual findings that the plea offer was not only addressed in the appellant's argument that given the significant reduction in sentence, it staggered the imagination for him to have not accepted that offer that they had offered.
Well, I don't think the testimony presented before the district court was clear. We clearly set out every step he took. The responses from the appellant after speaking to his wife, and they obviously testified otherwise. The letter that the prosecutor sent to Green basically supports Green testimony of what he did. Green testified that he told Schmidt of the offer, which was originally an oral offer, was not in writing, that Schmidt said, I need to talk to my wife. He did so. He rejected the offer on the basis that he was afraid he would not get out of prison. He didn't want to spend the 15 years in prison. Green then testified that Schmidt said, I would maybe take it if the state would recommend probation. The letter from the, and Green then testified that I will go talk to the prosecutor. The letter from the prosecutor states, I talked to the family about sentencing recommendations, and they don't think probation is appropriate in this case. And then she then went on to say that the original plea offer, the three class 3A felonies, still stands. So the actual letter in this case that the appellant is relying on to support his claim actually supports the testimony of what really happened. So I don't think it's automatically unreasonable to believe that he wouldn't have taken the deal because he could have got a lot more time if he would have gone to trial. And I think he believed in his mind he had the chance at trial, and he was acquitted of two felonies at trial in this case.
And didn't Green also testify that he told Schmidt that the previous offer that had been orally made had now been made in writing?
Yes. Yes, I believe so. And that he once again, after Schmidt rejected it again prior to trial, said, maybe we can talk to the prosecutor again. I think it was a good deal. I think maybe they would be willing to reopen that offer. And Schmidt one more time said, I'm not willing to do so. He was willing to gamble at trial to take the chance that maybe he wouldn't have to spend any time in prison because that's what he wanted. He wanted probation or no time in prison. Regarding whether or not the motion could have been filed while his appeal was pending, you know, I think it probably could have. The court wouldn't have had jurisdiction to do anything, but he would be following the statute if he had filed within a year. But I don't think it's necessary to get there on these facts because our district court did analyze the case on Orby and found that Schmidt was communicated, the plea offer was communicated to him back in 2006. So it wasn't timely either way. I believe I have gone through everything I intended today, so unless there are any additional questions, we ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you.
Much time, Mr. Gumpack? He has a minute 36 seconds.
Your Honors, on the issue of whether or not this is retroactive, I think it is. I refer you to the recent case of Nebraska versus Goins, G-O-Y-N-E-S. It was filed on April 8th, 2016, 293 Nebraska, 288. That's a discussion of Miller versus Alabama and how it applied to the facts of that case. But in citing Chewy Montgomery versus Louisiana, a 2016 U.S. Supreme Court case, our Supreme Court said when a new substantive rule of constitutional law controls the outcome of the case, the Constitution requires state collateral review courts to give retroactive effect to that rule. Well, you know, Your Honor, thank you for asking me. Because first of all, decisions of the Eighth Circuit are not binding upon Nebraska. They may supply guidance, they may be instructive, but that's not binding authority. State versus Albertson, on the other hand, I think is. And in that case, the language that the Supreme Court of Nebraska used is, we now clarify Frye versus Missouri, and we now hold. Albertson rejects the Williams case and says that just because that is not the law in Nebraska. I think so. Yeah? Let me see. I guess I'm all done, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.